Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is 8 o'clock. It's Thursday. This is LA Talk Radio, and you're listening to The Writer's Block. And I'm here in the studio. My name is Jim Christina, your host, with my lovely and talented co-host, Bobby Jean Bell, her husband, Jim, once again holding up his chair and headphones. And this is going to be a great show. I'm just so excited because I got so much stuff I need to talk about tonight. And first of all, I want to say that I did listen to half of your show this morning. And I really, really, really liked it. I never thought I would ever, ever, ever like Western Swing. And my God, I fell in love. It was just the best.
She's wonderful.
She was wonderful.
Yeah. And this morning, what Jim is talking about is the morning program that I am honored to co-host with Gary Holt on EquestrianLegacy.net radio called Campfire Cafe. And our guest this morning out of Chicago is a phenomenal jazz musician by the name of Susie Miles, who has now just released her first Western Swing album that is fantastic, called Susie Miles, Susie Blue, and
Susie Blue and the Lonely Boy,
the Lonesome Fellows.
Yeah.
And we played a lot of her music, and she was just delightful, and it was really, really fun. She's so talented.
Well, yeah, and then, you know, when I got done with that, I went in and listened to my daughter's podcast from yesterday. She has a radio show in North Carolina, and it's called Hump Dog Radio. Well, Hump Dog because it's Wednesday at noon, so it's like hump day. But her conversations were a little bit different than yours. And she actually, at the end of her show, she wound up talking about picking up your dog poop when you're walking your dogs. And it's a whole different world out there, I guess.
Internet radio.
Internet radio. Well, actually, hers is not. It's on an FM station.
Oh, is it on FM station? Very cool.
And then I want to mention a book that I finished, written by a friend of ours who actually will be a guest next month. His name is Joe Harrington. And I read a book that Bobby Jean had given me a couple weeks ago called Tekoa. Yeah. And what a story about buddies and loyalty and just wonderful, wonderful story. I can hardly wait to talk to Joe about it because it was just really, really got me.
I think everybody should read that book.
I think so, too. I think so, too. Why don't you let the people know who we have sitting in the studio with us?
We are delighted to have with us author Claire Fullerton. A happy accident involving a white dove that landed on the roof of tonight's guest, author Claire Fullerton, started her writing career. She is an award-winning essayist and contributor to numerous magazines, including Celtic Life, International, Southern Writers Magazine, and Got Ireland. A trip to Carmel by the Sea on the Monterey Peninsula and a stay in a historic hotel inspired her first published novel, and her career in the music business and a year in Ireland led to her second novel, Dancing in Irish Reel. Please welcome Claire Fullerton.
I'm so happy to be here. Jim and Bobby.
Oh, I'm just honored to have you sitting in here. It's just great.
We were having a lot of fun out in the green room chatting before the show.
Yeah, we were.
You know, I don't know. Do we have more to ask her?
No, I don't think so. I think we're all done. So I'm having a nice show, and y'all take care. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for the coffee mug. Oh,
we're not supposed to say that. You know what you said. I'm just going to jump right in. As we were talking a little bit earlier, I read the book Dancing. Was it Dancing?
Dancing
to
an Irish.
Dancing to an Irish. On Irish, yeah. And I really liked it. I'm not a romance guy, but it really isn't a romance novel. It's more a story of an immersion. It's a young lady who gets immersed in this culture and this music and this country, and it's just amazing. And the fact that neither she or this young man can manage to hook up.
You are so right.
And they're both afraid to make that final step to meet in the middle, and they just won't do it.
Indeed, Jim, and this was the point of the book, and the genre is actually literary fiction. And literary fiction loosely means true to life. The author usually wants to make some type of poignant point or commentary mm-hmm. on life. And it was my thought that the road to newfound love, when you're first meeting somebody and it's trying to get off the ground, it doesn't always have a happy ending.
No.
And it's not always a linear story.
Right.
And I don't know anybody that hasn't been immersed in, you know, doubt and confusion and fear, but it's still exciting and there's a lot of hope. And so true to life, all of that seems to be going on at once. And so I wanted to write a book about a stranger in a strange land, an American, you know, 25-year-old single American girl who leaves the record business in Los Angeles and takes a trip to rural Ireland, where she's offered a job that is too good to turn down,
right.
And so she stays. And so she's befriended by Irish characters that help her understand and navigate the nuances and the culture of Ireland. And in enters an Irish traditional musician named Liam Hennessy, who's from the western coast of Ireland in a region called Connemara. And when they meet, he's so unbalanced by the prospect of love that he can't figure out if he should come closer or go away. And so it's this push and pull, one step forward, two steps back.
Right.
And she's the American is thinking that clearly this is the culture. And everybody around her is saying, well, not necessarily. You have to understand how the Irish boys, especially the Irish musicians, are thinking.
Actually, I wanted to bop them both on the head several times.
Thank you. That was my aim.
I really liked them.
Yeah, I did too. But I have to tell you that the whole time I was reading this book, and from the start to the end, I thought to myself, no, this had to be written by somebody who actually lived it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing that our guest, Claire Fullerton, probably is Haley, or close to it.
Well, it's certainly my voice, and it's certainly my attitude and my personality and my take on things.
Because I don't think you could have written this book and not been there.
Well, and not lived in... Well, I did live in Ireland.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah,
For a year.
Let me clarify that. Should have established that on the front end. My apologies. I did. I spent a year living in an area called Invern, which is in what they call the Gaeltacht of Connemara. And by Gaeltacht, they mean the Irish speaking cradle of civilization, where Irish is spoken as a first language. And they really adhere to the old ways there. And it's where I was living was about 13 miles outside of Galway City, which is a vibrant college town. And you know, a university town, and the streets are cobblestone, and you can't drive in the city proper, and historically preserved. It's gorgeous. And so I kind of had the best of both worlds with the year that I spent in Ireland, and I certainly got to know the people just through keeping my mouth shut and just rolling with whatever it was that was going on, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and don't ask any questions and just roll with whatever's happening. And that's how I learned a lot.
Well, I imagine you would.
About the social nuances in Ireland.
Well, you did a good job putting it on paper. I mean, you could actually see where you're going, walking down the gravel roads,
oh.
and going to the old graveyards and the churches and the nightclubs.
And the stormy weather. You know, not ever having traveled there really felt like I was there.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad to
Absolutely.
Hear you say that, Bobby.
Thank you. And in the different pubs and just all of the environment. There's a fun quote, I think, on your website that says that you have this talent of trying on new environments like women try on dresses. And I think from reading both of the books, I would say that's very, very true, that you just put it on and you take us with you.
I think it's imperative that that writers have that. I think most of them do, is that ability to see the world from the outside in, that they're in it, but they're not of it, but somehow they're standing apart in witness of everything that's going on around them. You know, even in conversations, people, you know, you're fascinated in the people to the point that you see them as characters and want to report about it, mm-hmm. want to tell people
mm-hmm.
about it.
Mm-hmm. Let me take a couple seconds and tell you that the Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing. And out west? I can never remember.
It's out west. You can just go.
Thank you. Just go ahead.
Just go to scvoutwest.com.
Out West Boutique and Cultural Center.
Everything you need to know about us.
There you go. There you go. And Target Freight, which we'll be running their ad here in just a few seconds. And if you want to call in and talk to Claire, the number here is 818-602 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. She's over here cracking up. I don't know. What did I do?
Just keep doing what you're doing. Sooner or later, you'll figure out why I'm laughing.
Okay. Okay. Anyway, back to Claire.
So, do you have a question?
I was going to talk a little bit about her ascent to writing into novels, and I mean, you know, The White Dove is a nice story, but there's got to be more to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what actually taught you or started you in the writing genre?
Oh, without question, I started keeping a journal when I was 15 or 16 with no prompting from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt inclined to document my feelings, my observations, what was happening the effort towards trying to understand what mm-hmm. it was I was experiencing. It's a typical adolescent phase. And I'm convinced that was the start of my writing career because it really taught me how to be succinct, you know, and how to call things by name and all
mm-hmm.
of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I always did that. When I started submitting, the whole game changed. I started submitting poetry first,
mm-hmm.
And was published in a handful of places. But with regard to, and it seems to me that after I moved back from Ireland, I did write a short story that was published. Irish Poets Worldwide, which is an Irish community, is no longer, but at the time they were. And so that gave me encouragement, because when that short story was published, there were people writing in and saying, you got to write a novel off of this. And so I did.
Yes, you did.
And so I did. You know, so it was like that, but I had the fortuitous break of being offered a job that I was not looking for with the Malibu Surfside News, and I had my own weekly column wherein I just told creative stories about, I walked around the corner in Malibu the other day, and I ran into somebody, and isn't Malibu a wonderful place? So if you do 800 words on that on a weekly basis, it really teaches you how to have a good beginning, middle, and end, and a flow, and engage people in a short amount of time. So, you know, any type of writing that any writer does is going to be its own tutorial by virtue of the fact that you're engaged in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
I totally agree.
And once you submit and you start to rack up publications, I have found that my writing career has created itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also find that the more you write, the better your craft gets, and you
Indeed.
Just get, I mean, you hone it, you hone it, you hone it, you hone it, and you hone it, and, you know, eventually it's second nature to you.
It is, and I think for me, I write much in the way that I talk, and with regard to style and how did you find your voice, I thought, well, I never looked for it.
I never lost it. Yeah,
yeah. There's only one way to really tell a story, and that is according to who I am and in the way that I would like to tell it. I tend to be, as a bona fide Southerner, I tend to be digressional and long-winded. Writing has knocked that out of me. You know, you can't do that with the written word.
Well, you can be long-winded on this show. We don't mind.
Well, why don't I just take the show over?
Okay, fine.
It's yours.
You know what? It strikes me that you have this great Southern accent, and I have several friends. My best friend's from Jackson, Mississippi.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I love Jackson.
And he's got an accent much like yours.
Okay.
But I can't imagine a Southern girl winding up in Ireland and everybody's trying to understand everybody else.
You are so poignant. I cannot believe you just said that. Let me explain. The Southern accent comes from the Scotch-Irish that settled that part of America and the African-Americans. And if you think about what I just said, you'll see that I have a valid point. And the reason why is because Southerners, much like the Scotch-Irish, are lyrical and sing-song. And you know, oh, Bobby, I just love your lipstick. What color is that? Did you get that at the CVS?
Well,
you know,
I have to check my handbag and see.
And it's all up and down, and so is the Irish mm-hmm. Baroque. And, mm-hmm. and the Scottish, now there's a group that I don't understand what they're saying. You know, when you're,
or
well, they definitely roll their R's.
You don't know what they're saying.
Yeah.
but the Irish certainly are lyrical, and so you can see, as a Scotch-Irish settled that part of America, and with the blacks, and the certain forms of enunciation or lack thereof,
mm-hmm.
and the Scotch-Irish are the same way. The Scotch-Irish drop consonants as well, and so that's what it is. That's the reason why you have the Southern accent. And now y'all are going to be listening to a Southern accent differently from here on out. I can tell by the look on your face.
Well, actually, I had heard before that the Southern accent was from Europe. Well, from England, Scotland, and, you know, Ireland. And then Michael Caine once made a comment when he was in a movie and he had to do a Southern accent. And somebody asked him, well, how did you whip into that so fast? He goes, well, it's not hard because I'm English.
Okay.
And I thought, that's really astute. I mean, how do you figure that? But then you start listening to proper English words, and then you listen to some of the Southern ways of speaking, and it's almost identical.
Okay. Well, that's astute as well.
Yeah.
So. I think that the English, if anybody's a master at language and clarity of enunciation, it is the English. And I think that there's more license in the Scottish and the Irish accent that they're given license to sing, in other words.
Well, yeah. I think that it's funny because they both came from the same place. You know, they just spent years and years and years being apart. And the Scots got to be up there being Scots, you know, wearing dresses and carrying big swords.
in their infinite barbarism.
Yeah.
let's not stereotype.
I always like to know what inspires the creative spirit. What inspires you? Or who inspires you?
Everything. The thoughts in my head, you know, become runaway trains of their own volition if left unattended.
Oh, wow. And they actually let you out amongst living people.
That's right. Yeah. No, seriously. And I think that I'm fascinated because I've just completed my third novel. Or rather the first draft. You know, there'll probably be draft 3, 4, and 5, so I'm still working it. But I think that with Dancing to an Irish Reel and with this third novel and, you know, and from here on out with my career, that I'm always going to be making a commentary on human nature and human interplay and what it is that really goes on in people's heart and souls, what motivates them, what their fears are, and how they act as if none of it's happening. I'm fascinated in that. I'm fascinated in the subject of what goes on in families, sins of the father stories, and how children take off into the world with what it is that they've learned at home and hearth, and how they find themselves in, you know, therefore, in the predicaments they find themselves in. And so that is all the markings of an author that wants to be a literary fiction author, you know, for the rest of their days. And that's really what I see myself doing, because that's what I'm interested in and what I have something to say on, you know. But A Portal in Time was my first and quite possibly my last foray into, A, writing in the third person, and, B, just a complete fantastic story in terms of fantastic using the truest sense of the word in terms of fantasy or whatever. And A Portal in Time is a paranormal mystery, meaning not of this world.
A Portal in Time is a wonderful, wonderful book that takes us back and forth between the turn of the century, early 1900, and current time. It's a little 1999 to 2000 or so. And we have two sets of people. They begin to feel very familiar, one set and the other set. We start in San Francisco, but we're in Monterey, or in Carmel, rather, and you take us on a wonderful voyage of wonderful characters. The family that live in San Francisco, the main family that we meet in the beginning, are just delightful. The women, the way that you write women, we all want to be these ladies that you write about, each and every one of them. The mom and dad are fabulous. Tell us a little bit about Portal in Time and the characters. And
let me cut you off real quick. I have to spend some of Target Freight's money. We'll be back to you in 1 minute.
I will be here.
Okay, then.
Hey, Jim Christina here for Target Freight Management, the 3PL solution to all your shipping needs. Are you tired of your freight being reclassed? Tired of calling several freight companies for the best rate for your shipments? Then, of course, they reclass you anyway, and there go your rates. And Target Freight Management has a solution for you. Their customized transportation management system protects all of their clients from situations just like yours. If you're currently shipping a density-based product, you need to call Target Freight today. Target Freight is currently saving their clients between 15% and 20% off their freight costs, and that's a huge savings to anyone. They will even do a free cost analysis of your current freight program to see if you are a good fit for their program, and not everyone is. The kicker is, Target Freight is only paid strictly on the contingency they can save you money on your LTO costs. Call Target Freight Management today and just see what they can do for your company. Target Freight Management, 888-653-1323, or catch them on the web at www.targetfmi.com. That's 888-653-1323, Target Freight Management.
And we are back in the studio. Caught you, didn't I?
Probably so. I was saying that to my husband.
Just now joining us, we are in studio with Claire Fullerton. And if you are just now joining us, you've waited way too long because she's just a delightful lady. And she's so much fun to talk to. Okay, I'm going to let you continue with the question now.
All right. Well, we were talking about the book A Portal in Time. And Jim and I, my husband Jim here, have spent some time in Carmel. And so all of the part of this book that took place in Carmel, I felt like I was really there. Tell us a little bit about the two families' stories that are in this book.
A Portal in Time is a paranormal mystery written in two time periods. And there's a specific reason why I chose to do that. And I'm going to digress a little because I'm a Southerner and I can do that. And say that I got the inspiration for A Portal in Time when my husband and I had cause to spend a weekend at the La Playa Hotel in Carmel by the Sea. And as he was checking us in, I was looking around the lobby and I kept thinking, this looks like somebody's house. I mean, and then what we were talking about earlier, Bobby, when I was saying I like to pretend or try on new environments as if I were trying on a new dress, that's what I was doing. I was looking at the stairs that go up off the lobby, and they're Mediterranean tile and serpentine and, you know, very compelling stages. And I was thinking, well, if I lived in this house, you know, it would. And from there, I started thinking about the year 1901 and 1902, when I discovered that that hotel was built. And then I decided that that hotel was haunted. I got that in my mind. I woke my husband up at 2 in the morning, and I said, I can't sleep. This place is so haunted. And he said, go to sleep. And I started thinking about the premise for A Portal in Time, and I knew it had to be written in two time periods about a woman who remembers something. It's an uncanny sense of deja vu. And so, therefore, to answer your question, and was that long enough? You want another 10 minutes? Because I can give it to you.
It's a great book.
Yeah, but that's the reason why it's in two time periods that fit together like a puzzle. And I wanted it to be a fast-paced, page turner.
It is.
With a lot of foreshadow, a lot of innuendo, but the reader, while they're reading it, while they're immersed in it, has no idea that that's what's happening. But at the end of the book, on the last page, I wanted the reader to say, oh, my God, I should have seen it coming.
Uh-huh. You know? And what? And there's no more pages?
Yeah.
And what? There's no more pages?
It's over. It's done?
What?
Very intense.
Would you be willing to share a little bit and read a little bit of one of your books?
Oh, I would love to. How about Dancing to an Irish Reel?
I like it.
Would you like that?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, why don't I do that? All right, I've opened the page here just randomly on chapter 7.
I like random.
I thought you would. The distance between Invern and Clifton is approximately 60 miles. It is a visually inspiring hour-long drive through undulating midlands with grass as soft as velvet, gray stone walls that split the landscape, and bubbling intermittent streams as you glide along a two-lane road that cuts through a terrain devoid of street markers, stop signs, or any other indication the area has previously been trodden. There is little suggestion of civilization anywhere in sight, and it is a quiet, unobstructed journey through the heart of Connemara, with nothing in store save for the destination of Clifton. One more paragraph. Driving into Clifton, one is abruptly thrust into the center of a thriving village that hosts an annual three-day music festival, wherein every pub is invitingly open, with signs outside announcing which Irish traditional musicians will be playing within the standing room only venues. A rudimentary chalkboard sat in the sidewalk outside of Mannion's pub, with Welcome Liam Hennessy sprawled across it in large, eye-catching cursive.
Mm. I like it. I'm like right there, you know, and I remember, right. And, you know, you also lyrically write about the language of music.
Indeed.
Oh, and just music kind of, I'll say in general, not necessarily Irish traditional music, just how music is so special and you honor the musician in the way that you write about music.
Thank you so much for noticing that. It's very important to me. But yeah, I did mention in the book that there's a secret language that musicians speak that only they speak, and it's almost telepathic at its core. And I described a scene in the book wherein I am sitting in witness of a recording session that's going on, and I am the only layman there. And yet I have reason to be there, but you have to read the book to find that out. But I'm just sitting in the corner observing how they're communicating with each other through, you know, one raised eyebrow and one key, you know, touched on the keyboard, and it would elicit either a smile or a furrowed brow, and this entire conversation has taken place with no words exchanged. Mm-hmm. And more often than not, that is how musicians communicate, that, you know, you're communicating through music and words get in the way.
Yeah, all of the passages on that had to do with music I read them multiple times. Like I would just stop and go, okay, I'm reading that one again. I'm reading that one again because I'm not a musician, but we work a lot with musicians with our concert series, and we interview a lot of musicians. And I have such respect and feel so honored to be around musicians, that everything that I can learn about what it is to be a musician is really important to me.
I think they're bent and wired, you know, blessedly so, mm-hmm. a very specific way. And I think that if you keep your mind in that realm for long enough, you know, it garners and elicits something very specific. And it's beautiful and it's magical and it's otherworldly and it's other dimensional, and for musicians, it's a way of being in the world. I mean, they are that when they're walking down the streets. It's not just when they're picking up an instrument. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I used to immerse myself in it, and I music was my life. I was a musician for a number of years.
What instrument?
Banjo, guitar, piano, bass.
Cool.
And I had a group, and I did most of the writing. And I just, you live in your instrument, and as you're sitting in the studio and you're recording, you're right. Nobody talks. Just the nuance that everybody knows where to go from here just by looking at him going, you know, nodding and saying, go up a key.
Completely.
Yeah. And it's everybody knows, boom, it's done.
You're in a flow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And everybody's a part of it.
One thing I noticed about your book, and I have to say that I did like this book a lot, but when you speak of the music and the Irish music, you are speaking of the traditional Irish music more so than the modern Irish. It's not river dance. It's more of the old traditional stuff with the accordions and all that.
Yeah, the mellotron, the concertina. They are instruments as revered as the soil of Ireland themselves. And Irish traditional music is passed down. It's not necessarily ever written down, mm-hmm. but it's passed down generationally. And there are master players over there. I mean, you can't even believe it. And Irish traditional music because it's all happening at once.
Mm-hmm.
Now you'll have three or four instruments all playing pretty much the same thing at different octaves and at different paces at the same time.
And that's really hard to do.
Thing. Yeah, and there's a reel and there's a hornpipe and there's something called an air. And air is slow and moody and lyrical, haunting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, think that the musical instrument, the alien pipes, that type of thing. And, you know, it is its own torch to the Irish culture.
Yeah, I asked an Irish guitar player that I knew once in Seattle if he ever took lessons, and he looked at me like, are you joking, mate?
Well done.
They didn't take lessons. He didn't know. He never took a lesson in his life.
And they don't, they're not guitar pickers over there. They play the guitar in Irish traditional music as if it were percussion.
Percussion,
and
right.
So it's very thrash,
right.
You know, all the way through, and it definitely keeps the rhythm.
Yeah, for sure. Let's change tact here for just a few seconds. And for 9 years, you sat in a studio much like this one.
Well, five different ones.
Yeah.
Are we going to talk radio?
We
now?
Are going to talk radio right now. And you were on the air for 9 years.
I was.
Why don't you just give us a little backstory on that?
Well, okay. And this was in Memphis, Tennessee, where I grew up. But I started running the board in talk radio. And, mm-hmm. and they had the big old-time broadcasters that would come in wearing a coat and tie to be on the radio. Nobody would ever see them. And I was what was known as a producer. And I screened their calls, told them who was holding on the lines, extremely, extremely regionally popular shows, all live, of course. And I learned how to run the board, as they say. And from there, I started doing non-commercial radio. And I did Memphis music shows at two different radio stations. And then I got involved with a non-commercial jazz radio station. And I was basically, you know, just getting used to being on the air, reading the cards, doing everything and running the board and getting comfortable. And then I was hired to run the Rick Dees and the Shadow Stevens on disc mm-hmm. at the biggest station anywhere in the Southeast. It was FM 100 was what it was called. And, you know, it goes into four different states. And anyway, I sat there from midnight to six and, you know, on a Sunday night, was lucky to have the job and just basically spun the recorded disc. Mm-hmm. And there was a country music radio station down the hall, and its music director came down and said, it was the classic little girl, I want to make you a star. He took me down the hall. He said, I want you to read these three liner notes. I did. He recorded me. He went back down the hall, and he said to my employer at FM 100, if you're not going to hire her and put her on the air, then we are. Because we have an opening right now. They said, take her.
nice to be wanted, isn't it?
I know. And I started on the air within a couple of weeks, and it was terrifying. I'll never forget the first time I opened up the mic and knew that, like, the world was listening, and I couldn't even speak. I was so intimidated. And then I got over that, and then I ended up from there going to the station that I really wanted to be on the air at, and that was called WEGR. Rock 103, which at that time it was called album-oriented rock, which means the cuts, the singles from the albums, if you were Tom Petty, mm-hmm. you know, or anybody, that type of thing, the singles from the albums you were putting out is what was album-oriented rock. And so I was a, you know, technically, if you want to give me a label, I was a rock and roll DJ in Memphis, Tennessee on Beale Street.
That's so cool.
I wonder if that'll be part of book three.
Well, you never know.
That would be kind of fun. There's the ghost in the radio
yeah.
station.
I'll see if I can work that out.
Well, I mean, I think that would at this point be book four. What motivates Claire Fullerton?
I think communicating.
Yeah.
Honestly, my life has turned into a full-time job of writing, and I'm very grateful for it because it seems to me that on any given day, weekends including, I'm writing something for somebody somewhere. And you find that, you know, once you put a couple of books out, that you're involved to a very large degree. And I do have a publisher, Vince Byer Publishing, who's been great. And they do a lot of work, and they really get your name and your book out there. But in this day and age, the author is really expected, and it's to their benefit, to help to get their name out or and the name of the book. And so you find that there's this big universe out there of book people and book sites and blog sites and review sites. And, I mean, I could keep you here and bore your socks off telling you about, you know, what is out there. And, you know, I'm at the point now where I think, is there another world that exists outside of the book world? Because it doesn't feel to me like, you know, I'm privy to it these days. You know, I'm in my cave writing whatever it is I'm writing, and so it's that. And there's an Irish community called the Irish Geese, and they are worldwide, and they are a group of historians, people that write books. I mean, these people that are part of this community are not messing around artists, and the people at the helm want the Irish Geese to be all about the Irish community. So you've got a lot of Irish Americans that are writers, novelists, musicians, whatever, contributing to this site.
We have a caller.
Who is this?
I have no clue. Would you like to find out?
I would.
Okay, then. Hi there. You're on the air with the Writer's Block. Who am I speaking to?
Hey, Jimmy, it's Russ.
Hey, Russ, this is my co-host when Bobby's not here. You'll be here next week.
How are you? I was just listening, and I tell you, what really got my attention was the talk about being on the radio, because I went to school and studied in college to be at that time, a DJ is when you actually talked on the radio mm-hmm. rather than spin records mm-hmm. In the clubs. And I remember having to actually get a third-class radio operator's license before you were able to even be on the air, and that's if you didn't even touch equipment. And doing the editing by reel-to-reel tape, where you had to actually physically cut
right.
the tape and splice it together, it was pretty fun. That just brought back a lot of memories for me. So I thought it was kind of fun.
Golly, I'm glad we could wake you up.
Yeah, you know, I sit at my desk nodding off, and they're talking, I'll listen.
Hey, did you want to say hello to Claire?
Of course. Hello, hello.
Hello, Russ. How's it going?
This
excellent.
Is Russ
it's
Addison.
Been a nice interview. I've been really enjoying it.
Well, good.
I'm glad you called.
All right. We'll go back to it, and have a great night.
Well, you're up next week, pal. Yep.
All right. Good
all right.
Night.
See you next week. Bye-bye. And that's my part-time ghost.
He's a great interviewer. You'll have a great show next week.
His thing is, he says, I don't know anything about writing. I said, that's what makes you a good interviewer. You ask the questions that people want the answers to.
Exactly.
Yeah, see? So it works out for him. And he's great. I mean, Russ is a great guy. He's just a big honking hockey player. Take it away, Bobby. What you got?
Well, speaking about writing, I'm kind of curious. What comes first, the title to the book and then the book? Or does the title reveal itself to you as you're writing? Or how does that go together for you?
The book first, and the title is always going to come from some line delivered somewhere in the book. You know, at least that's been the case for me. You know, having written three novels now, it's always some line that is somehow telling in one title of the nature of the book, the spirit of the book, the underlying concerns in the book. Mm-hmm. I like the idea of something suggestive and mysterious and not overt, mm-hmm. And I pull titles that way. I mean, that's just my personal choice.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you should say that, because I grabbed a title on one of my books from the center of the book, and the premise is that the book's title is Long Ride to Morning, and these two guys just escaped the Apache attacks, and they're riding through the middle of the Stone Canyon in the middle of the night, and they're scared to death that they can hear them coming from 100 miles away. And his friend Bobby turns to Stryker. He says, what time is it anyway? He goes, I think a little past midnight. He says, I guess it don't matter much. It's a long ride to morning.
Exactly.
And exactly. They just hit you, and they just come out.
And I think it's beautiful to position a title that way. And then, of course, you've got the reader with the book in their hand, as
right.
it were. And they come across that line.
Yes, they do. And they go,
that one instance that they have to say.
All right, let me run another commercial, and we'll be back in about 30 seconds or so.
Hey, Jim Christina here for TFM Truckload, a division of Target Freight Management. TFM Truckload is here to help you with all of your truckload and railroad shipping needs. If you want a reputable company who is going to work hard to find you the best rates while maintaining the best service, then TFM Truckload is who you need to call. When TFM Truckload books a truck for your company, it shows up 100% of the time. So if you want a reliable truckload broker, then call TFM Truckload today. That's TFM Truckload toll-free at 844-653-7789. Or if you're a web guy like me, go to www.targetfmi.com. So give them a call at 844-653-7789 or catch them on the web.
And we are back, and if you're just now joining us again, what's taking you so long? We're here in studio with Claire Fullerton, just a delightful guest. She's just been wonderful to talk to. And Bobby, I believe that you have the question.
Oh, I get to ask it tonight. Well, this is called The Writer's Block, and we do enjoy hearing the answer to, do you ever experience writer's block? And if so, how do you handle it?
Go ahead, Claire. We know what the answer is.
This answer's going to irritate you. I've never experienced it. I believe it's a myth. That's my interpretation. Everybody banters it around, and I don't know why. I mean, is it cool? I'm experiencing writer's block. I mean, does this suggest that you're somehow brilliant, but your brilliance has just been interrupted momentarily? I mean, what is it that people want to get out of latching on to, you know, to the idea of writer's block, and why is it so prevalent is all I want to know. But I think the answer is an emphatic no. I've never experienced it.
So, Eric Heisner said the same thing, remember?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he never did it either. And, you know, with all the questions we've asked all these authors over how many shows now? Since April 21st.
Yeah.
We ask everybody the same question, and you take it and you just boil it down to one simple answer, and I agree with you. I don't think it exists. I think it's a writer getting in front of himself and doesn't know how to catch up.
That's well said. You may have a point. Let's say when you're writing a novel and you may have gotten through a scene and you know where you're going next, but you're not quite sure, and you think, you know, I need to have a bridge that's going to get me from this cataclysmic moment into this next one, because it's going to be too much if I do this back-to-back, and yet I want to tell both scenes, for lack of a better word. I write in scenes, and so I call them scenes. But if you need that bridge, you may have to go outside and take a walk, and you may have to let it go until it comes floating to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole thing is don't worry about it, because I believe that it's a process, and I think that writers are writing even when they're not writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's, mm-hmm. there's that thing bubbling mm-hmm. and churning and, you know, coming up to the surface, and it will express itself, but it's in its own time and its own way. And I think that if you believe that, and further than belief, if you know that to be the case, then you're not really worrying about it. You're doing yourself a favor and just kind of taking a step back and getting your breath.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I told y'all that every once in a while we go up to Carmel and, you know, and I get to points where I need to take a break. I need to go up to Carmel, and we bring our German Shepherds up there and we walk around in the woods, you know, and I just sort of decompress. And I'll have my laptop and I'll be working on whatever isn't pressing. Whatever, but I mean, I want to enjoy the writer's lifestyle, and I don't ever want to be stressed over it or feel like it's, you know, there's some looming deadline or any of that. That takes the joy out of it and the entire purpose of why I do what I do. You know, it's.
Well, I totally get that.
Yeah, so coming full circle here, the writer's block. I mean, one's either a writer or they are not, and they're in it as a lifestyle. And involved in the process, and it is what it is. And even when they're, you know, their fingers are not on the keyboard, it doesn't make them any less a writer. It just means that in that moment, you know, they're watching TV.
Having a shot of bourbon.
That's right. I mean, you're allowed to do other things.
You know, I mean, yeah, you're a writer. You can do pretty much anything you want, and everything's relevant.
Yeah, I mean, what I aspire to is I don't want to take myself so seriously. You know, that I start painting myself into my own self-identification box.
Yeah.
I mean, that's boring.
Yeah.
That's really boring.
Yeah, it really is.
What types of books do you like to read yourself? What do you enjoy?
I tell you what I love, and I'll tell you who I love, okay? I love the Southern writers. I'm a colossal fan of the author Pat Conroy. I've read every book he's ever read. I find him to be a master of the English language, a very lyrical writer. The way that he crafts a story. It's not enough to have a good story. You got to be a master of the craft, and it's an entirely different animal. And so, you know, he gets my scepter for the king, you know, and he gets the ermine cloak, you know. And other than that, I love the author Ann Rivers Siddons, who's got 24 books out, all of them set in the Deep South. I really enjoy the Southern writers. I am wildly intimidated and enamored of the author Donna Tartt, who wrote The Goldfinch and The Secret History and The Little Friend. And now there's a writer that puts out a book once every 10 years. And they are teaching the world how to write. I mean, she is so good that I can't believe it, you know. And of course, The Goldfinch, which everybody knows, the only criticism about that is it's a 753-page novel, and who in the world, you know, got the patience for that? But she is, and she hails from Mississippi. But she is a master as well. And so when I read, I'm not just a casual reader. I am, you know, a cheerleader, and I am enthralled, and I'm going to school. When I have a book in my hand, I am paying attention to what they're doing and how they're doing it, you know. And not to say that I want to emulate anybody. That's not my point, you know, because you've got to ride with the beat of your own heart if you're a writer, and you got to ride that way. Or it's not going to, it's going to ring false. And so, you know, but when I do see writers such as the aforementioned, I just think, you know, these people were put on the earth with a gift that they developed. It's the art of communication in its highest. And Lord, if they didn't sit down and do it, you know, and however long it took them to develop. But, you know, I think with writers, it's all spawned from a recognition that you should be doing it. You should be there in the arena doing it to begin with. And if you just stay the course, you know, it all sort of blossoms from there. And I think that these writers that I mentioned, and, you know, and I study them, and I'm curious as to who they are and where they live and how they live and what their story is, mm-hmm. and how they became writers. You don't wake up one morning and you're a full-fledged novelist. You know? I mean, it doesn't work that way. And, and so I'm always fascinated in the different avenues that have come mm-hmm. to those, you know, wise enough and passionate enough to stay the course.
I sure hope that any young writers out there that are listening to her talk right now are kind of soaking some of this mm-hmm. in. This is very good advice. Very good advice.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, you're welcome, Claire. Well, which incidentally is a nice Irish name, Claire.
Yes. Well, my grandmother was the original Claire. And she was named after County Clare. But if you're a female, it's C-L-A-I-R-E, which is the case with me. And but County Clare itself is C-L-A-R-E. Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. and it's a male name. There are men in Ireland named Clare.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. Well, we were talking about advice for writers when we were chatting with Claire earlier. We talked for just a moment about social media. And you are a kind of a master at that. Can you just...
Well, I am now.
Yeah. Because it is wonderful to give some guidance to authors that are out there. Can you give us a little tidbit about what you do with social media that's successful?
I'd be happy to. What you want to do is get to the book buying public. And the world is online, and so much of books are bought online. Mm-hmm. And we all know this. And so... Because the whole world is online and on social media, what I did, you know, over a course of about, the first year, let's say with the Portland Time, was created an author page, Claire Fullerton Author, on Facebook. And I have my Facebook page for all of my friends that I grew up with in, you know, in Memphis, and they no longer am impressed by the fact that I have books out. They don't care. They would rather see pictures of my dogs, you know. And so that's the reason why I've got an author page on Facebook, and I've got... a presence on LinkedIn and on Google Plus and on a site called About.me and on Stumblr and on StumbleUpon and on Tumblr. On Pinterest, I have a presence with about 8 different boards, one of them my German Shepherds, one of them Carmel, because it pertains to a Portland Time. Things that I'm interested in, one board that is Claire Fullerton Author, and so... You find that you're working your books as an author, but you're also getting your presence and your interests out there so that people will see that, you know, I'm interested in this author. She grew up in the South, and she's into German Shepherds. Okay, let me see what she's about. And it is that way. It's that way with all authors, that the lion's share of the promotion is done online. There are a myriad of book sites, blog sites, review sites. It goes on forever, and the thing to do is to figure out who these blog people are, where they are, and you write them and you say, "Dear stranger that will never meet me face to face in your life, mm-hmm. I am an author and my book is, you know, I would love to be a featured," you know, and everybody works this way, and it's a very gratifying, symbiotic relationship for the bloggers that are there for a reason. They love what they do, and they love talking about books, and they love interviewing, and it certainly helps the authors out, and the people that are looking for new books you know, go to these sites habitually. Mm-hmm. You know, once they get a good recommendation, they're going to go back, and you know, it's like that, and it's a lot of networking with other authors, And it's a lot of reading what other authors are doing. Twitter is a big deal. There's a site called Books Go Social. They're a promotions outfit. They happen to be out of the UK. But this is the biggest network I've ever heard of in my entire life. You get involved with Books Go Social, and they are tweeting out your book to thousands of people a day.
Well.
So it's about getting in the traffic, if that makes sense.
Jeez.
So what is...
That's a tenth of what I've got to say to you.
What is, speaking of, because we are, I know our time's drawing to a close.
They're going to be standing out there going,
What is your website, or what's the best way for folks to get a hold of you?
Well, my name is Claire Fullerton, and it's spelled C-L-A-I-R-E, and Fullerton, just like Fullerton, California. So you can find anybody online by simply typing in their name.
Right.
And my website will come up. It's just www.clairefullerton.com. And I am everywhere. You can Google me. You can search me however you want to search me.
That is absolutely true. Because I found her.
You will find out more about me than you ever wanted to know.
I found her all over the place.
But we learned a lot tonight.
We did. And
the books are available on Amazon.com, right. Barnes & Noble, Google Plus, Smashwords, anywhere that you can get a book, an ebook, an audiobook, which is the audiobooks, you know, people love those, and in print. And so anywhere that you ever buy a book, you know, you'll be able to find either one of my books.
Very nice.
This has been so fun.
Thank you so much. It's
been great having you. I just so appreciate you coming in and spending the time with us.
What a joy. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Maybe someday you'll consent to come back.
Well, we got a booker for next year because you're telling us we're already booked through.
We're already booked through June.
Half a year, so.
You all are the hottest show in town. I've never heard of such popularity.
Oh, shut up.
I'll go on with yourself.
Yeah. I'll have the bookie get a hold of you. In the meantime, this is Jim Christina, and with Bobby Jean Bell, we're going to kiss it off for another Thursday, and we'll be back next Thursday at 8 p.m. Western, 8 p.m. Pacific time, which is 11 o'clock right coast, and all around the world. Until then, everybody take care. Have a good week.